Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's October 23rd, and this is the third quarter wrap-up. As you know, the wrap-ups are my favorite. Every wrap-up, we pick out a big theme and take an in-depth look at something we think is very important to your lives and your futures. And this wrap-up, we've looked at the Chinese stock market. We have a web presentation up. It's divided into three parts. The homepage, where we cover the Chinese stock market. The second is the top stories and trends for the quarter. The last is financial markets with the same charts we used for the third quarter equity overview. A week after we prepare the audio and publish this audio report, we will also have the PDF that will then be produced into booklet form. So you can follow along with the PDF if it's ready. If not, you can follow along with the web presentation. And I'm going to be discussing tonight both the Chinese stock market stories and trends, the financial market charts we reviewed in the third quarter equity overview. And if you'd like a overview of those, I would click, go into your library and click into the equity library and get the third quarter equity overview. Next week, I'm going to be reviewing and chewing through the stories and trends with Dr. Joseph Farrell. He's agreed to give me a sort of an interview wrap-up response once a quarter. And so we will also go in more depth into stories and trends next week, and that's a great interview. I really encourage you to listen to that as well. So let's just dive in the Chinese stock market. I interviewed last year Steve Roche and spent a fair amount of time digging in and talking about China. And then, of course, in the annual wrap-up, we talked about the rebalancing of the global economy. And one of the things that caused me to keep doing that is I have discovered as I travel and have lunch and get the opportunity to speak with you permanently, personally, what I discover is there's a tremendous amount of misconceptions about what's going on in China and in the relationship between China and the United States. And so we've talked a lot about the rebalancing and how the traditional or the relationship of the last 20 years between the United States and China truly has to change. They have to build their consumer markets. We have to save more and rebuild our producing capacity. So there needs to be a rebalancing, and at the heart of it is both of our stock markets. And the Chinese equity markets are very interesting. China, which originally had stock markets before the Communist Revolution, stopped them during the period, it's really 40 years, from 49 to 1990, and then relaunched them in Shanghai and then in Shenzhen the year afterwards. And so literally within 25 years, the Chinese equity markets have gone from zero to 7 trillion, which is really an astonishing compliment. That's 10% of the value of global equity markets. And if you include Hong Kong stock market, it's nearly 15%. If you include all the stocks cross-listed around the world, it's even more. So the growth has been nothing short of astonishing. And I put up a series of charts on the web presentation, and please, as you listen to this, I would encourage you to click and take a, you know, follow along with the web presentation because it's very helpful. The three charts, one shows the Shanghai Composite Index compared to the S&P. Since 1990, when the Shanghai market started, it's up 2,500%. The S&P, obviously a much bigger, more mature market, is up almost 500%. So five times, if you left your money in China, you'd be up five times more than in the S&P, but the reality is you would have had quite a volatile ride, as you can see from the chart. So quite a roller coaster. If we just look at the period 2009 to date, which is really a big shift with the U.S., the real crash in the financial markets and a big wake-up call to China, and really a re-engineering of the relationships. If we look at just 2009 to date, we see the S&P up 128%, China up much less, 75%. So in the last 5 years, the S&P has grown ahead of China, which is obviously a reversal of the first chart. But as you can see, for a period during this year in the spring, the China had really started to move ahead before it came crashing down. And then finally, in the third chart, just to put things in perspective, I compared Apple to the S&P and to China. And as you can see, Apple skyrocketed significantly over since the January 1, 2009 period. So if you were in the right stock, you're way ahead of China and the United States. Needless to say, Apple's gotten significant growth from China. Another symbol I added to that chart was the long-term treasury. To give you a sense, you know, a lot of people will tell me that they're sitting in bonds because it's safer. Well, yes, you would have had a lot less volatility sitting in bonds than you would have had sitting in the S&P or China or Apple. But the reality is, you can see over time, it makes an enormous difference if you're getting an equity yield and dividends as opposed to sitting in bonds that are paying almost nothing. As I said, this year has been a very rocky ride. The Shanghai Composite Index was up almost 60% for the year as of June 12th, and only 2 months later, on August 25th, it nosedived 43%, closing year-to-date at that point down 9.5%. So we've seen extraordinary volatility in China for many years, and this year is certainly no exception. And one of the things I wanted to look at, given what I suspect was the economic warfare going on, is this really a place worth investing in? Is this really worth my time as an investment advisor to focus on? Should I be recommending to people that they have the money in the Chinese stock market? So I wanted to take a deeper look. So this market is important, and one of the reasons it's important is if we are going to rebalance the global economy, then we need both the United States and China to be successful, which means we need their equity markets to be successful, not just because we need them to be successful. But the reality is, if we're going to get out of the debt model and into something more balanced with equity, we need the equity markets to be successful. So as Steve Roche said in his wonderful book on balance, we're like Siamese twins. We're tied at the hip. And if there's a way we can find to increase each other's power and to cooperate, it behooves us. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the Anglo Alliance, we continue to dominate across the financial markets. I put up a chart from a recent Economist story about called Dangerous and Dominant, about the real trajectory of the U.S. dollar. And one of the things it pointed out is the extraordinary market share that the U.S. and the Anglo-American Alliance, but for the chart, the U.S. has in across the financial board. We manage more than 50% of assets, and it's extraordinary asset management position. At the same time, the 2007 or 2006-2012 period with financial bailouts and the subsequent central bank interventions have really raised serious doubts globally about the integrity and management of G7 financial leadership and markets, whether it's the volatility and corruption in the Chinese and the Asian markets, or the corruption and it's a very different kind of corruption in the Western markets. There's a lot of reasons to distrust each other. There's a lot that needs to happen in the Chinese markets if they're going to be as successful as we'd like them to be. One is you need a much more open flow of onshore and offshore equity capital in and out. China has been reforming and allowing that to happen. It was one of the reasons for the run-up this year, as we'll discuss. But there's a lot more maturity that needs to occur, particularly in cross-listings. Cross-listing is when a Chinese company may also list in Europe and the United States and Hong Kong. It's a variety of different options. And clearly, we need a more stable and broader institutional and retail investor base in China. The China market is really defined by retail investors who are fairly speculative, and you don't begin to have the kind of base that you have in the U.S. markets. to date, the process of achieving these goals has been very, very organic, and I suspect it's going to continue to be. And one of the reasons is if you look at the risks that the Chinese market faces, you've got significant cross-cultural challenges with the Chinese dealing with the West. You have enormous regulatory complexity. China is a very big country, and at the same time, we're dealing with the unraveling of the Bretton Woods system and the emergence of a multipolar global order, and there are a lot of geopolitical tensions in it, which again was one of the reasons I wanted to sort of step back, take a deeper look after watching the Chinese market take such an extraordinary swan dive and say, look, you know, is this a place I want my money? The thing to understand about the Chinese market is it's very young and very big. It's very rare for anything to be this big and this young. It's now the second largest stock market in the world. At the same time, if you look at the float eligible for foreign investment in the domestic, their domestic market, it's still smaller than Japan. So big float, not all eligible for foreign investment. While the stock market is relatively young, China's culture and country is not. You know, they think of themselves as a pretty ancient place, and they are 5,000 years old. They're also, they think of themselves as the center of the world. If you look at their name in Chinese, the characters, it means Middle Kingdom. It really does imply they're the center of the world. And when you think about it, it wasn't that long ago that they were the largest economy in the world. The mantle is just returning to them. It was the industrialization in the West that, you know, that put them out of the place of number one. But now think about it. Their markets have only been open for 25 years, and their markets are now the second largest stock market in the world. That's quite extraordinary. And so one of the things we've seen happening recently, I wanted to point out there's a very good series on the Chinese markets in the latest Morningstar magazine, and I recommend it to you. It goes into much greater detail, and I think is one of the good overview pieces that you can get on the Chinese market. It's very current, just published. China has been taking steps to open the cross-border flow of capital even more. It's part of China trying to get their currency adopted globally and trying to really position themselves on the global stage. One of the big decisions this year, there are two big financial decisions. One was the emerging market index funds were going to make decisions as to whether or not to include China A shares in their indices. And in fact, some of the run-up in the Chinese markets this year was front-running as the local retail speculators using margin debt anticipated the foreign funds would have to make significant purchases of the China A shares. MSCI decided not to include yet. It postponed the decision. Vanguard decided that they would, and I put two of those articles up. The MSCI decision to not include really paralleled the IMF's decision to delay inclusion of the Chinese currency in the SDR system until 2016. And in both instances, you see the Western financial establishment demanding greater maturity from both the Chinese exchanges and currency managers. On the other hand, their concerns regarding the long-term costs and consequences to Anglo-American alliance dominance as China joins the club, I think, was part of the decision. And things got very suspicious when the Tianjin explosions rocked the markets. And I think that was part of the problem in August. I suspect that that this was economic warfare at its worst. And what was very interesting was after it finished rocking the Chinese markets, it reverberated back and really rocked the U.S. markets. And I suspect what we might have seen was an unexpected lesson to all the parties that competition within legal boundaries is preferred by investors. The world's getting tighter and the tricks aren't working the way they used to. One of China's challenges, it's got to transform from an export economy. The real rise of China came about, now, this is how I describe it, very grossly oversimplified. China bought U.S. treasuries, which then financed government checks to U.S. consumers who ran down to Walmart and bought Chinese goods. And around we went. But it created a manufacturing juggernaut that really contributed to a false prosperity for the U.S. consumer. And the reality is now China's going to have to transform from simply an export economy to a more mature economy. Now, there are many challenges of doing this. I just want to go through a couple of them. One is what we're seeing is significant developments in a wide range of technologies that we've talked about a lot on the Solari report, the shift to global 3.0, whether it's robotics or telecommunications, fabrication technologies, or material sciences. All of that, it means that the developed world can insource a lot more manufacturing, bring it back home, or have that manufacturing done in local markets. That means to remain competitive, Chinese companies are going to have to automate as well. And it's going to dramatically shift the advantages of manufacturing in China versus other places. And the question is, given that, how is China going to provide sufficient employment opportunities? And with that, dovetailing with that, is you see very significant unemployment and inequality issues between the coastal cities and inland where things are prosperous and the rural areas to the west. And that could present formidable political challenges and risks for Chinese leadership if the population does not have employment opportunities. The second thing is China has an aging population, and it doesn't have a governmental social safety net to depend on, and that's part of the problem of getting China to shift away from a high savings rate and start to consume more. They really don't have a social safety net, and so consumption is a more expensive proposition. Environmental pollution, one of the things that happened by outsourcing low-cost manufacturing to China over the last 20 years was we really exported our environmental pollution to China, and now China really is facing a very serious problem, and it's going to have devastating consequences for the health of the Chinese people unless they address it. Infrastructure. China has built very significant infrastructure over the last 25 years when the export machinery to both Europe and the United States slowed down as a result of the sort of financial downturn and austerity in Europe. One of the things we saw was China kept its growth going by increasing its debt, and that included significant investment in their housing stock and in infrastructure. When they've started to turn and try and take that infrastructure building and engineering capacity and offer to start to finance infrastructure and build infrastructure for the BRIC nations. And regionally, we saw them propose the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. The U.S. didn't take kindly to that. To a certain extent, they saw it, rightly so, as an end run around the IMF and the World Bank. And it redoubled their efforts to push through the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What the U.S. was facing was lots of trading partners throughout the world, but certainly throughout the Asian region, were slowly, you know, China was becoming a much more important trading partner to them than the United States. And so the United States redoubled their efforts to sort of lock everyone in before that got worse. The other thing is we saw a part of what we're seeing in terms of the withdrawal of forces from the Middle East is to give the military the capacity to pivot to Asia. And at this point, I think, given how much domestic development there has been of oil and gas, U.S. is increasingly worried about its position in Asia as opposed to about the Middle East. Finally, military and space. China has made very clear that they expect to expand their force projection globally, whether it's their to move from a regional to a global satellite system, whether it's to send space missions to the moon, both military and space. They want to have the kind of global infrastructure it takes to build a very important global currency and financial infrastructure, and to be a player in the command of space, which is critical if you're going to be a player in the financial system or the economy here on the planet. So it all raises a very important question when you look at their plans on the military and the space side. With production capacity breaking free on planet Earth, is it possible to have a politically and economically productive space race? Because that's where we're headed. State-owned enterprises, which you'll see many research and financial analysts say is the number one problem with the Chinese equity markets, is that the prevalence of state-owned enterprises. This is a comparison which I don't fully buy into, and I think is worthy of some much more serious analysis and sort of academic study than I've seen. The reality is, if you look at the U.S. companies, there many of them are highly dependent on federal government contracts and purchases. We often refer to these companies as privately owned and operated. They're not. It's just not the case. And in fact, you'll see situations where the government or shadow government essentially considers the company to be a proprietary because of its dependency on the government, and it really expects it to operate on behalf of long-term strategic interests as opposed to optimizing profits, particularly in the short term. We've talked about many examples of this on the Solari Report. Great interviews with Jim Norman on the Oil Card about the oil companies really acting in concert with long-term national security interests. Numerous industries like mortgage credit and financing and the bank credit is highly socialized with the federal credit. And we see when they get in trouble, they get bailed out. So we're talking about very deep, state-owned enterprises in the United States. We just have a much more subtle and invisible way of sort of implementing it all. But the reality is we see very significant collusion between corporate interests and the government in both the U.S. and China. And I've never seen a comparison, a serious comparison that really looks at how the two do it, how they're the same, how they're different. The danger in China is that political interests will have the upper hand, and you've certainly seen plenty of corruption go down, local governments stripping companies for the benefit of the local company government. The danger in the United States, of course, is that the economy will be destroyed in the interest of consolidating cash flows into corporate monopolies created, particularly, with massive political contributions. The reality is both China and America are struggling with too much intimacy between centralized government, large corporations that has bred significant corruption, and it detracts from healthy long-term performance. And I think the question for many of us at the Solari Report is, frankly, how do we avoid all of it? But there's a need for serious analysis and comparison of the real relationship between corporations and state in China, the United States, and the G7 nations. This runs around the world, this question. And so I think I would love to see a more serious analysis. And in fact, if you look at the Brit-Chinese relationship, it's growing much stronger. Britain clearly sees an advantage of building out its financial services by being the partner in the West, which is most aligned with the Chinese, particularly as there are enormous tensions between China and the U.S. right now. So that would be a perfect example. The reality is we have a hidden system of finance and a black budget, and those need to be taken into account, and, of course, increased investment space by both the G7 and the BRIC nations is only going to exacerbate this sort of government-corporation relationship. One of the reasons that the Chinese stock market is so volatile is that it is dependent on a relatively small base of retail investors. The majority of Chinese people are not stock market investors, and they don't have a big pension fund system. So, and if you look at Chinese personal saving, it's still primarily channeled to real estate properties, gold, bank deposits, but not to the stock market. If the Chinese stock market's going to succeed, it must develop a broader base of retail and institutional investors domestically. And I've talked about this a lot, both in Planet Equity and the annual wrap-up and in a number of the equity overviews. We really need, if we're going to build a cooperative equity model on the planet, then the emerging middle class globally is going to need to become global equity investors. And so that means it's very much in our interest if the Chinese people broaden their interest in ownership, not just of Chinese equities, but ultimately global equities. So where did I come out? What is an investor to do? After much research and soul searching, here's how I'm going to approach the Chinese stock market. First of all, this market is way too big and important to ignore, so I'm an investor. I'm an investor now in the Chinese stock market. I'm going to be an investor in the Chinese stock market. The second thing is I anticipate significant volatility. We've certainly seen it in the past. There's no reason to think it's going to stop. And what that means is I don't want my portfolio participation in this market to be greater than the relative contribution of China to the global GNP. So if the Chinese markets are 10 or 15% of global GNP, that's going to be a cap on my portfolio. The second thing is I'm only interested in investing in stocks or funds that I'm prepared to hold through significant downturns, because I'm going to have to hold them through significant downturns. I just think this market has volatility and it's going to have it for some time. And that means the quality of governance is essential. You know, I need a board and I need management that can manage something through a significant downturn. That also means the dividends matter. Because if you're going to hold something over a long period of time, you want to be getting paid to do it. The next thing is, for a portion of my Chinese investments, I'm going to be looking for derivative investments. So there are many high quality companies and markets that are more mature than China, like Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia, or in G7 companies that have a significant brand presence in China. So there's a way to participate in the Chinese growth and the Chinese market without necessarily getting some of the immaturity and the problems by playing in the derivative markets. And by derivative, I don't mean derivative instruments. I mean derivative locations that are part of that flow, but have more mature governance and ecosystems. I think there is a real problem now with emerging market ETFs, how much they include of China, whether and how they include them, and whether they have a limited or a one country a cap. What we're going to be seeing is ETFs that really have or funds that really have a very high concentration in China. So I think now it's going to get complex as to what's really in an emerging market ETF and how we define it. So I think from here on out, it's going to be very important to do your due diligence. There's going to be wide variation depending on how they approach a number of questions, one of which I think the most important is going to be how much China. I think the economic warfare and geopolitical tensions between China and some of its neighbors and the United States are going to continue to ebb and flow. That means lower investment returns and increased volatility. And unfortunately, I hate to say this, I've struggled with this one for a long time. It means the best time to buy is when there's blood in the water. So if I'd done this analysis before August 25th, I would have been a buyer on August 25th, but I hadn't done this analysis. But I assure you, if we get another August 25th where the market really gets whacked hard, I'm going to be looking to buy. Given the size and complexity of this market, I'm also going to look for active fund managers who specialize in China and have historically outperformed the China index funds. This should be a market where a lot of excellent expertise should make a difference and really add what's called alpha. And for all the obvious reasons, I'm going to continue to track the emergence of a global middle class, of which China is an important part, and what that is going to mean to the markets, not just in terms of companies and the companies that are serving and what happens to serve those markets, but whether that global middle class becomes an investor and a buyer of equity securities. So what this means is this rebalancing the global economy means that you and I live in very interesting times. And I, when it comes to dealing with markets that are this treacherous, I wish you good luck and good hunting. We've added a tremendous number of links. If you really want to familiarize yourself with the Chinese equity markets, we've got all the links and some great books and articles, and I would encourage you to have at it. There's some really good stuff in there. Okay, stories and trends. I have to tell you, the third quarter was a fascinating time for me. I had said earlier in the year, and I'd said all along, that the third quarter would be a very intense time geopolitically, because so many arrangements had been kicked down the road, but they were coming to a head and had to be dealt with. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was an example. But there were many of them, so I had said things were going to, you know, we're going to see major turns in the third quarter, which we did. And the other thing I said was we were way overdue for a correction, and I thought it was very likely we got it this year. And, of course, we did get a correction in the third quarter. Everything was really down. What most defined the third quarter for me, however, was not those things, but the fact that so many people in my life, in my world, in our subscriber base, were absolutely fell prey to an unbelievable outpouring, unbelievable effort of what I would describe as fear porn to try and talk them into the end of the world, you know, the global financial collapse, the collapse of the dollar. And most of these scenarios were simply absurd on the face of it. But the marketing was quite intense, and it became very frustrating with me to try and persuade and help people sort of stay grounded. And it was one of the reasons we put together a commentary with a calendar of events in the third quarter, and then ended up coming in or out of Labor Day, doing a Solari report on what's up this fall. My big concern was that that people's time, our subscribers' time, was being wasted by what I call shadow work. We did a commentary on shadow work and had a big section in what's up this fall on shadow work. And sure enough, during the third quarter, a great survey came out from Chapman University. And if you look at what Americans' top fears are, they're very knowledgeable about the fact that they're getting hit with enormous amounts of shadow work as a result of corrupt leadership and digital systems that have no integrity, financial fraud, and all the other things that we talked about. So I would say the third quarter, I made an extraordinary effort to try and to help our subscribers and my clients really look through the noise of the fear porn into what was really going on and stay grounded in the reality. And, you know, it was. We had a lot of geopolitical deals being made, a lot of world leaders gathering, a lot of things coming to a head. And we had a correction in the markets, and there it was. That was the third quarter. The other thing that happened to me that was very important and of great concern is every 4 years, I'm astonished to find that anybody, let alone hundreds of millions of people pay attention to the US presidential campaigns. If Barack Obama has proved anything at all, it is that what a candidate says during an election is completely irrelevant to what happens after they get elected. And so it makes no sense to invest any of our time listening to what these people say or do, because frankly, it's completely irrelevant as to what's going to happen. And I think if you look at the state of the nation, as I talked about money and markets this week, it's time to get serious. We got to yank our kids out of school and start organizing to shift our tax money out of the educational system into something that will finance a real education. So it's time to start shifting money and start shifting our attention in very powerful ways. And I think there's no better way for you to save time than to ignore the US presidential elections and ignore the fear porn. So those are two big time savers that I hope you avail yourselves of in the fourth quarter. If you just run down the top stories, let's just run down them quickly. China, bigger footprint, that was a major topic all throughout the quarter, is the growth of China and the fact that China now is the number one economy and number two stock market. And with a per capita income still below $10,000 per person in a rebalancing of the global economy, they're going to continue to grow. The reality is they've got 1.4 billion people. That's a lot of people. The other thing we saw in the third quarter was really symptom after symptom of the limits of the U.S. power. The Bretton Woods system is unraveling. The U.S. is pulling in their horns, whether we're bringing manufacturing back into the United States, whether we're stepping down the military presence in the Middle East, so that we can shift out to Asia, whether we're tying in all of our allies into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then coming up the Trade Services Agreement and the Transatlantic Partnership that has yet to be negotiated. But we're watching the adjustments being made as we start to pull in our horns and reduce the military commitments that were unsustainable that we committed to after 9/11. Deflation is clearly in the air. Some of the oil price coming down, no doubt, is checkmating Russia. But the reality is commodities have come down harder and stayed down. A lot of insiders have gotten hurt and gotten surprised. And one of the big things we face now is the question is how are those lower commodity revenues that they've kept low, how are they going to translate into problems, credit problems in the debt market, particularly the junk model, the junk market. G20 pushes for growth, another big set of stories. We see with the Snowden revelations, the BRIC nations, Moscow, China, moving to do their own payment systems, their own credit cards, their own infrastructure banks, on and on and on. And of course, that continued throughout Q3, and it was part of what was creating a lot of the tensions. The end of the bond bull market, we've been talking about for 2 years. The Fed did not raise interest rates, which was going to be the real ring the bell on the bond market. If anything, they've kept interest rates low, and now there's tremendous pressure for more QE, and we're certainly seeing QE here in Europe. So, but the fact is that you've had widespread acceptance and formal discussion within the bond community and the financial media, making it clear that the bond bull is over. And so the question, of course, is where is all this money going to go and what's next? And this is going to be a very slow process. Part of this, of course, as I said, was we saw high yield bonds drop to a real low as there were continued concerns about credit issues. Here's the thing, we've printed far more bonds than there is capacity to carry those bonds. So to a certain extent, the part of the problem with the end of the bond bull market is you've got a game of musical chairs. Refugee mass migration, the pouring in of immigrants within Europe, major, major development this year, and certainly the explosion of migration was very evident in Q3. Being here in Europe, I saw it, felt it, and we've talked about it and written about it. But it's continuing also in the United States. There's no doubt about it. I think that this level of migration is part of what is being used to checkmate the rising power of an angry middle class in both Europe and the United States. I had a big section called Leadership Tag, You're It, the Chapman University survey that was published right after the third quarter, but expresses what was happening this year, including in the third quarter. Makes it very clear that America's top fear is corrupt leadership, which shows you that the American people are very smart. We even had Jimmy Carter, former U.S. president, come out, give an interview saying the U.S. is an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery. You know it's bad when you have a former president complaining at that with that kind of extreme statement. I think there was nothing more corrupt in the third quarter for me than watching a representative of the Catholic Church and Vatican come and be treated with such tremendous respect. Here's the reality. When institutions behave in the manner in which the Vatican has behaved, we need to shun them. We need to drop them. You can't put a new face who says a lot of words as opposed to take real concrete action. If the Vatican ever decided to shift all of their financial networks and resources, watch the world change. But instead, they put a guy in charge who uses a lot of nice words, and everybody buys back into it. That's not holding institutions accountable. So for me, I think the shocking thing is to see so many people pay attention to whether it's the U.S. presidential campaign or the Pope. We keep buying into these institutions, you know, as if we were codependent Patty Hearst types. So that to me is really shocking. I don't understand why it keeps happening. I can't explain it without entrainment. But the reality is when institutions behave in a way that inspire literally for several decades, billions of dollars of settlements for pedophilia, you know, that's an institution we need to shun permanently. And it doesn't matter what face they put on top and how many new faces they churn in and out and what those faces say. It's all just words. It's not real action. It's not real institutional change. So I think it's time. You know, it's time to walk away because things have gotten pretty serious. So I think leadership is very, very important. And if you look at everyone listening to this discussion, we are all paying a very heavy price for poor leadership. If there is one thing that is destroying the economy, it is lawlessness and the absence of civilization. It's inhumanity. And it's the most deflationary thing going. Another story that I listed was the push for vaccines and the mysterious death of the natural doctors. There's no doubt we have forces running around and assassinating, or no doubt in my mind, we have forces running around and assassinating doctors, particularly doctors who advise people not to get vaccines. We had a very interesting situation with the CDC scientist admitting to destruction of vaccine autism documents or destruction of documents related to a vaccine autism study. So this issue of vaccines and holistic doctors is an incredibly important one. And it's another one why, in addition to Common Core and the testing and what's going on in the schools, I think it's time where simply for safety reasons, we're going to have to pull all of the kids out of the school. I know that sounds like a very challenging thing for a busy parent, but the reality is that we're hitting a tipping point. Another story, as I said, equity markets corrected, and believe it or not, the thing that was the strongest in the market, to my amazement, was the U.S. consumer. Imagine the U.S. consumer holding things up at this point. Blue chip volatility, whether it was the nosedive of Procter & Gamble or the Volkswagen scandal, we're in an environment where competitors are dishing out dirt on each other's, and it can swing a blue chip stock by an enormous amount. And so the volatility is reaching all the way to the, you know, the companies that have been the most stable financially. And going forward, if you can pick your way through it, of course, it creates an opportunity for many people. It's pushing them towards index fund and other very broad baskets. And finally, as I said, fear porn hits new high. This was a particular, as I said in my discussion with Dr. Farrell, I lost my temper over fear porn this quarter. As I said, I had a great conversation with Dr. Farrell, and we dove into these and other stories in the third quarter in much greater depth, and that discussion will be published next week. And I encourage, if you want to go into these in more depth, that you definitely listen to that discussion. Great. I always love talking with Joseph about what in the world is really going on. So take a look at the web presentation. As I said, a week from when we publish, we'll have a great PDF and turn that into a booklet form. So access the web presentation, get the PDF, take a look. If you have questions, please post them on the blog and we'll try to address them. I was reminded going through this wrap up again, it always helps me to sit down and distill things and really go through, collect up all the stories and get down to the essence of what happened. But we're really beginning to see major geopolitical shifts globally as we go from the Bretton Woods system to a multipolar world, and the U.S. pulls in its horns. And it's going to make for very, very interesting times. It's one of the reasons that I spent time in Asia, in Australia and New Zealand, and time in Europe. I really need to be out and about to understand that rebalancing and what's happening. And I'm very happy that I did. It's just much, much better insight as to what's happening and what's going on than if you're just sticking in one place. So don't be surprised if you see me tootling around. And sure enough, tomorrow I'm headed for Scotland and the UK for a week before I head to Austin, Texas for the Secret Space Program. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of you there. So that's the third quarter wrap-up. It was a very productive quarter for us at the Solari Report. We're very excited about the fourth quarter. Our annual wrap-up is going to be on the space-based economy. I'm going to start that presentation at the Secret Space Program economy. As I talked about tonight, we're really seeing productive capacity breaking free and on planet Earth, and that's part of swinging resources in, and it means we're going to expand what we're doing in space. So not only are we rebalancing globally, but it looks like we're rebalancing in the galaxy. So ladies and gentlemen, it's been a great pleasure to be of service to you in the third quarter, and I look forward to doing, if I can, an even better job in the fourth quarter. And I wish you all the health, wealth, and prosperity. And if there's anything we can do to contribute to that for you, you let us know. So with that, that's the third quarter wrap up. Remember, if you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start with. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.